Thanks for tuning in to Silence is Violence, Stories of Financial Education. Before we begin, we want to acknowledge that a lot has changed in the world since we recorded in December of 2024. But we believe the conversations, insights, and information remain relevant. Hope you enjoy. I'm Chloe McKenzie, your host of Silence is Violence, Stories of Financial Education. And I'm a traumographer, someone who studies and maps financial trauma. I am also a wealth justice activist and the founder of Black Femme and 107. Growing up in Prince George's County, Maryland, one of the only counties where Black families out-earned and had more wealth than white families, I saw financial privilege and abuse work hand in hand. I briefly found fulfillment as a mortgage trader on Wall Street while providing financial counseling to Black women on the side until it made me sick. From there, Black Femme was founded and provided me with renewed focus on healing financial trauma while propelling Black women forward. And now, 107 allows me to achieve wealth justice on a larger scale. I was a visiting scholar at Georgetown Law Center on Poverty and Equality, an Ashoka Fellow, and a learner in residence at Springpoint Partners. And now, I am continuing wealth justice work and research as a visiting scholar at NEFI. Addressing wealth justice requires addressing a spectrum of financially driven issues that I call the wealth justice journey. Through my research, I have found that wealth justice starts with identifying the financially driven actions, which I call financial abuse, that are bolstered by an oppressive system. When financial shame is present and felt as people participate in the economy and experience this systemic financial abuse, it indicates that a deeper financial trauma exists. To effectively address financial trauma, it requires a focus on changing the system rather than focusing on changing individual behaviors and actions. The ultimate goal we are driving towards is material safety, which is the feeling or inner knowing that you are protected from experiencing economic violence like financial trauma. Feeling materially safe indicates that we have adequately addressed financial trauma, enabling people to safely navigate a harmful system. Given that I created the theory, I define financial trauma as the effect of being systematically exploited, harmed, and/or betrayed by an economic system and its institutions that concentrate wealth and power in the few, namely those who enjoy racial, gender, class, and ability privileges. My research aims to get at the root cause of racial and financial inequity and provide new visibility and insight into just how widespread financial trauma is within our communities. Every year, hundreds of millions of dollars are spent on financial literacy. Yet studies have historically shown low to moderate effect sizes on financial behaviors. In other words, it alone does not improve financial well-being. Recently, though, there have been some hopeful changes to these findings, but we still have so much work to do. Understanding financial trauma and the basic tenets of wealth justice helps us understand why. In this podcast, we advocate for a more ecosystems-based understanding and framing of financial education. You'll notice that I use the terms financial literacy and financial education throughout this series. There is a clear distinction between the two. For the purpose of our discussion, financial literacy refers to one's level of knowledge and understanding about specific financial concepts, while financial education involves the systematic coordination of approaches and processes that facilitate financial knowledge and decision-making. Financial literacy can serve as one possible outcome of financial education. In practice, an ecosystem-based approach to financial education means considering varied voices, policies, institutions, theories, and even experiences, and how all of those things interact to create the circumstances through which financial education is delivered. Over the course of the next four episodes, financial education researchers, equity leaders, and organizations will come together to discuss the harmful history of financial literacy and its cultural impacts, why grounding financial education in identity and cultural understanding matters, financial education theories and solutions that consider the intersection of financial literacy, financial shame, and financial trauma, and how organizations and research practitioners are using financial education to advance wealth justice and what all of that means for us. In this podcast, we say the silent part out loud, breaking the silence around financial trauma, inviting experts and those with lived experiences to reimagine the system we operate within, its impact on individuals, and how we might rethink financial education to advance wealth justice. Thank you so much for being with me on this journey to uncover the complex layers of financial trauma and consider how each of us can be catalysts for change. This is episode one. Complicated relationship with financial literacy. This is to say, I've spent much of my career rhetorically interrogating both its benefits and its harms. And I've spent the last 10 years effectively asking, how do we best utilize this tool to improve wealth outcomes for the most marginalized communities, knowing that financial literacy is far from a panacea and can even be a part of the harm that most experience when participating in the economy. In some ways, I felt as if I've been on a pendulum swing. In 2019, I was on a national speaking tour to spread the good news, if you will, on all things financial literacy. And then I took a really sharp turn in 2020. I just found myself so frustrated about the wealth gap, the harm certain groups, particularly Black women, have to experience when they participate in the economy, and trying to understand where financial literacy fits in all of that. I do believe financial education is an essential tool to closing the gender and racial wealth gap. And I also have been concerned about how it could, and frankly has, depending on how and what is taught, how it perpetuates experiences of financial trauma and harm. So today's episode is a story within a story, maybe even within another story. It's the story of the distinction between financial literacy and financial education, its history, and its significance to American culture. It's the story of what's missing, what's important in this context that has been missing, and what important themes and threads about this exciting moment that we are in need to be highlighted. And to some extent, it's my story. It's the story of how I've been grappling with my own opinions of financial literacy and the importance of financial education. So, if you're ready, let's dive in. Today, hundreds of millions of dollars are spent on financial literacy. As the financial landscape we operate within has become increasingly complex, and using credit cards, mortgages, and loans have become more common, so too has the teaching of basic skills needed to manage income, debts, spending, and investing. As of 2024, more than half of the states in the United States have mandated financial literacy education as a graduation requirement for high school students. As of 2025, specifically, 27 out of 50 states require students to complete a financial literacy course before receiving their high school diplomas. A 2024 meta-analysis on the effects of financial education on financial knowledge displays positive causal treatment effects on financial knowledge and financial behaviors. Specifically, the estimated or weighted average treatment effect is at least 3 times as large as the weighted average effect documented in the first meta-analysis of this literature, which examined 13 randomized controlled trials or RCTs. In contrast to earlier studies, this study did not find differences in treatment effects for low-income individuals and the general population, and it didn't find evidence to support a rapid decay in the realized treatment effects, although the study did not find support for the sustainability of long-run effects either. That was a lot of research wonky speak, so in other words, the study did not find financial education less effective for low-income populations or that the effects wore off quickly for low-income populations or general populations, which it did show that in the past. But it also did not find that financial education produces long-term sustainable effects. The data I just referenced is relatively new, and up until this meta-analysis, it has been heavily cited that there is a rapid decay and realized treatment effects. I'm hopeful that this study finds positive causal treatment effects on financial knowledge, but the inability to confirm support for the sustainability of those effects also leaves me wondering, why? And what can the field do better? To answer this question, I did what I always do. I talked to myself about it out loud. The way financial education is delivered matters. Studies show that financial literacy programs offered through companies and schools are not often well-resourced, practitioners are poorly trained, and they are poorly conceived. In general, we can definitely and definitively say that one-size-fits-all approaches with little to no follow-up generally don't do well or lead to impactful outcomes. So I remind myself, yes, the quality and mechanism through which financial education is delivered matters. Yes, it has the power to promote better outcomes. But in order to truly pursue wealth justice and advance wealth justice, we have to acknowledge how financial education is intrinsically tied to the structural factors that lead to the ever-widening gender and racial wealth gap in the United States in the first place. And we then have to ask ourselves a few questions that are central to my research. Now, before I get into those questions, I want to acknowledge that not all financial education is bad. In fact, there are many organizations and people that approach financial education by acknowledging that the system we operate within is oppressive by design and craft financial education to match the experience of the learner. But as a whole, we still have a lot of work to do. So please behoove me and consider the following. How does our nation's history inform the system we operate within today and the outcomes from financial education we are witnessing? How can we sit in this discomfort and face the totality of the problem? And finally, how can we continue to acquire understanding and knowledge that is necessary for healing and change in the financial education field itself? Now, while we won't arrive at all of the answers to these questions throughout this series, we can explore them together. And to understand our present, of course, we must first go back to our past. It has now been about 110 years since the Smith-Lever Act of 1914 was passed, which was the first federal policy that instituted and recognized personal finance. The Smith-Lever Act established the concept of formal financial education when the Cooperative Extension Service was created to offer outreach program to educate rural Americans about a range of topics, among them personal finance. Now, in general, presidents in the 1920s were focused on rehabilitating the American South from an economic perspective. And during this time, there was one researcher, Hazel Kirk, who helped lay the foundation for consumer economics and family economics, or really what we know as home economics today. She took this newfound energy around personal finance and asserted that it should be central to the ways individuals operated in and interacted with the world. So much so that she wrote her entire dissertation on it at the University of Chicago. One of her most pivotal works that is cited even today was a 1923 article on consumer behavior and consumption and why it is necessary for economists, policymakers, power brokers, and the like to think about the ways we participate in the economy. This emphasis on the importance of personal finance also coincided with the transition into a new economic landscape post-World War I and the economic advancement that happened thereafter. This period of time really institutionalized the idea that we have a personal responsibility over our finances and economic well-being. And this maxim took hold in our culture. That is until 1929, where the idea was complicated a bit. The Great Depression abruptly ended the economic prosperity of the 1920s, and the nation suffered catastrophe. In response, FDR created the New Deal to promote economic recovery and put Americans back to work. Through federal activism, new federal agencies attempted to control agricultural production, stabilize wages and prices, and create a vast public works program for the unemployed. Many Americans got a foothold in the middle class through the New Deal. But many forget the crucial fact that Black and brown workers across the country were systematically excluded from programs like Social Security, as well as protections under the National Labor Relations Act. Now, why would that be the case? Well, our economic system was premised on slavery. It is fair to say that the intended outcome of our economic system is to at least restrict, if not completely eliminate, certain groups from full participation in the national economy. A big part of the story of financial education has to do with the way we as a society are quick to erase the harsh truths of our past and fortify narratives like that of individual responsibility over our financial circumstances. Even in moments of economic crises we did not create, we fortify these narratives to ensure that the designed outcomes of the system continue to happen. Let's run it back and take a look at the whole history and the whole story to identify where financial education fits in as it begins, even before the Smith-Lieber Act. And before doing so, I do want to offer a gentle trigger warning as we do briefly discuss sexual violence and the atrocity of slavery as we dive deeper back into history. As we take a look back, I do believe that the most effective way to tell the whole story is through the experiences of Black women. That's at least what I've done in my research. In 1787, virtually no cotton was grown in the United States. There wasn't a huge increase in production of cotton until after the War of 1812 ended in 1815. By 1820, participating in the Atlantic slave trade was criminalized in the United States. But somehow, enslavers were able to produce 2 billion, with a B, pounds of cotton per year by 1860. Think of how heavy a single piece of cotton is. So you can only imagine how much work it would take to pick enough to weigh 2 billion pounds. Since enslavers could no longer steal the people who would generate all of the wealth in America, they would ensure that Black women were responsible for birthing the hands that would generate that wealth. Saying the silent part out loud, rape and wealth creation became intertwined. Rape was enterprising. Narratives from enslaved Black women of the time noted that they were marketed and purchased on the basis of their desirability as sex partners. As rape became the socially and legally sanctioned wealth-building model, local and state banks invented banking tools to steer more money into the cotton economy. Mortgages were taken out on enslaved people and how many enslaved children that women could potentially produce to buy land and pay other debts. Enslavers' debts were securitized and pooled into sellable chunks, and this was for those who tried to pretend that they were reluctant or could be removed from the atrocities by trading in the secondary market until there was a liquidity crisis and a subsequent financial crash in the 1840s. Sound familiar? These financial crises required that even more enslaved people be sold to raise cash for the enslavers who are now awash in debt, which added an even greater burden on Black women's bodies. By the 1850s, the economy had rebounded and was more profitable than ever. That was until the Civil War. Now, at this point, many would say that American capitalism completely changed during the Reconstruction era. But really, our economic system just reinvented itself. From sharecropping to redlining to denying work protections to domestic and agricultural workers, which were largely Black women during the New Deal era, and even wage discrimination. All of these are examples of the reinvented mechanisms to restrict certain people from fully participating in the national economy. The new wave of ensuring certain socioeconomic outcomes entailed financially traumatizing groups targeted by racism, sexism, and other forms of oppression. But equally important to achieving these outcomes was ensuring that culturally, we all felt mostly, if not wholly, responsible for our socioeconomic experiences. In August of 2022, I wrote an article published on NEPI's website about understanding racial trauma's impact on financial literacy. At the time and still today, there was and is a general consensus that there is a growing need for financial literacy because economic inequality is worsening. David Raymond, a Roy H. Park Fellow in the School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, found that financial literacy is most often measured at the individual level. He found that the most common operational definitions of financial literacy are budgeting, saving, borrowing, and investing. Culturally, we are thoroughly convinced that financial literacy is our best answer to economic hardship. But believing that mastery of budgeting, saving, borrowing, and investing can ensure economic prosperity is how financial literacy and oppression, namely white supremacy, are connected. After thinking about this history and in the early days of conceptualizing my theory of financial trauma, I grew increasingly frustrated with financial literacy. Well, really, I grew increasingly frustrated with the embedded legacies of oppression within financial literacy that, admittedly, I hadn't spent enough time grappling with. And so I began to question whether I was even a proponent of financial literacy anymore. I went on to say that I was no longer a proponent of financial literacy because of its embedded legacies of white supremacy and how, when taught in certain ways, it could lead to experiences of financial shame at best, and even financial trauma or re-traumatization at worst. While I still have some of those thoughts, I have reoriented my focus on financial education, which refers to the systematic coordination of approaches and processes that take individuals' identities and cultural contexts into account. This is where I have landed. Culturally, we have been thoroughly convinced that financial literacy is our best answer to economic hardship, and this is a legacy from the Smith-Lever Act and all that came after it, as we've already discussed. But placing the onus on the individual and believing that the mastery of budgeting, saving, borrowing, and investing can ensure economic prosperity does not place financial trauma in context as one of the largest influences on a person's wealth-building capability, as my research suggests. The influence of financial trauma on the individual and collective wealth-building of people cannot be understated. If people, especially marginalized people, are navigating financial trauma, it is truly damaging to suggest that they just need to know better in order to do better. I want to be clear. This isn't to say let's get rid of financial literacy. In fact, this podcast is saying the exact opposite. This is to say we are missing key context and we have to ground ourselves in the harsh truth in order to advance wealth justice. We have to say the silent parts out loud. When financial literacy furthers the belief that the cause of financial stress, financial shame, and financial trauma is not structural, but simply behavioral, it negates the reality of our history and the legacy that remains. This instills a sense that experiences like poverty and debt are less a societal or structural problem and more a consequence of bad individual financial choices. In the Black communities I have partnered with in my work and research, financial literacy tends to focus heavily on skills like budgeting, saving, investing, and actively avoiding debt. And these concepts are used to empower Black individuals to achieve their financial aspirations, such as homeownership and retirement security, or the creation of generational wealth and addressing historical racial wealth disparities. But the data still show that racial gaps are not letting up. Often, financial literacy centers on obtaining assets that involve specific conditions or requirements that ultimately depend on conventional models that either aren't applicable, they aren't relevant, or more so, they aren't even accessible to the learner. Delivering financial literacy in this way can and often does cause experiences of financial trauma and financial shame. And delivering it in this way can lead folks to feel like the socioeconomic harm that they experience is their fault. In fact, that's the conceptual definition that I created of financial shame. When we become accustomed to asking what is wrong with you as opposed to what happened to you, we participate in victim blaming and refuse the idea that there are multiple ways people can be experiencing financial trauma when they participate. This was reinforced in the study I conducted with Black women in St. Paul, Minnesota, which we'll talk more about in episode 3. So if you ask me, where am I today on the love-hate spectrum with financial literacy? I would say that's actually not the right question. And frankly, that may not be the right question for any of us to ask. But yes, financial literacy is necessary, and our nation's long history with embedded legacies of oppression is missing from the narratives around our celebration of financial literacy. This is why understanding financial trauma, studying what it is and what it does to us, is critical to the next wave of what financial education is becoming and can be. And note, the intentional use of financial education, which facilitates financial knowledge and decision-making for the long term. One of my favorite authors is Sue Monk Kidd. She wrote in one of her books, To Live Your Questions. I'm happy that I've done that as it pertains to my questions around financial education. and I'm still living this question and exploring it in my work. For me, I feel like a much better question to ask is, since we know the importance of financial education, how do we get it to a place where it can be used to manage financial trauma and navigate our economic system? That is the best part about living this question. It's learning that so many amazing people and organizations are doing this work already, and you'll hear about that in the coming episodes. The next wave of financial education centers individuals' identity and interweaves cultural understanding. It provides access to economic opportunities and pathways to reliable sources of income to manage, balance, and invest so that people can actively benefit from the focus of financial education and participate in the economy without harm. It doesn't obscure the systemic issues that create institutional barriers and exposes the unfairly placed burden on marginalized groups to navigate obstacles with limited resources. And most importantly, it doesn't promise or purport to say that it is a panacea to all adverse socioeconomic experiences and outcomes. It stands as a powerful tool that can be helpful, but demonstrates why broader systemic changes are ultimately needed. We're at an important turning point, an important moment, one that advocates for a shift from individual responsibility to reconsidering the system within which we all operate. So, carpe diem. In the next episode, I am thrilled to be joined by Dr. Michelle Samuels-Jones, who is the Senior Vice President of Equity and Engagement at NEFI. She will join me in conversation to explore and discuss how financial education is evolving to recognize identity and cultural competency, and hopefully fluency. We'll dig into strategies and approaches in the field today that support individuals and their communities in a more inclusive way.
We can come at this from a space of altruistic beliefs and say, you know, it's for the good of, and I believe in all that. There is evidence that shows when you center the experience of those you're serving, whatever the content is, whatever the material is, whatever the information is, it holds and is believed and is used and becomes empowering and equipping in a very different way.
See you next time.
Silence is Violence, Stories of Financial Education is produced by the National Endowment for Financial Education, a 501c3 nonprofit that is the independent, centralizing voice providing leadership, research, and collaboration to advance financial education and financial well-being. The opinions and statements made on this podcast are those of the podcast participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of NEFI or constitute statements supported by NEFI. Links to our event summaries and any other documents discussed in this session are available in the show notes. For more information, visit www.nefi.org.